If other imperialist powers were able to displace U.S. dominance in the region, the dollar would be dealt a severe blow. The pressure for switching to the euro would become irresistible and would ring the death knell of dollar supremacy.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Friday, October 3rd, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. White House employees were given until Tuesday to turn in all documents that might aid investigators looking into who leaked the name of an undercover CIA officer to a columnist. Alberto Gonzalez, President Bush's legal counsel, sent a memo to employees today saying that to comply with deadlines set by the Justice Department, all materials must be turned into his office by 5 p.m. Tuesday. He said materials covered by the order include all electronic records, correspondence, computer records, notes, and calendar entries. Employees also must sign a certification form saying they have turned in materials or do not have any items related to the investigation. Investigators are trying to determine who leaked the identity of Valerie Plame, a CIA operations officer who has served overseas. Plame is married to former Ambassador Joseph Wilson, who has accused the Bush administration of selective use of intelligence to exaggerate the threat from Iraq. The Justice Department is conducting a criminal investigation into the leak of Plame's identity, which first appeared in a July 14th column by syndicated columnist Robert Novak and later was reported by Newsday in a story by Timothy M. Phelps, Washington bureau chief for the Long Island New York newspaper, and Kenneth Royce, a staff writer for the paper. President Bush said today that the Iraq war was justified despite the lack of evidence of weapons of mass destruction. Congressional Democrats countered that a report from the chief weapons hunter, David Kaye, shows that administration claims Iraq posed an imminent threat were unfounded. The president also shrugged off polls showing rising doubts about whether the war was worth the cost. Sometimes the American people like the decisions I make. Sometimes they don't, Bush told reporters. But they need to know that I make tough decisions based upon what I think is right, given the intelligence I know. Democrats already hammering the president over his $87 billion request for military and rebuilding operations in Iraq quickly latched on to Kaye's interim report as further proof that the attack on Iraq was ill-advised. House Democratic leader Nancy Pelosi, emerging from a briefing with Kaye, said it was, quote, clear to me that there was no imminence of a threat for weapons of mass destruction, end quote, as the White House had claimed. Senator Carl Levin of Michigan, the top Democrat on the Armed Services Committee, after a separate meeting with Kaye today, said the report reinforced the need to look into the reasons pre-war intelligence could have been so far off and whether or not it was exaggerated or whether or not it was hyped, either by the intelligence community or by the users of that intelligence. Well, when CIA weapons inspector David Kaye announced today that his team has failed to find any weapons of mass destruction in Iraq after 3 months, he also went on to say he had discovered evidence of WMD-related program activities and equipment that Iraq concealed during UN inspections in the year 2002. The Bush administration repeatedly said that Saddam Hussein was an imminent threat to the safety of the U.S. because of his vast stockpiles of chemical and biological weapons, not because of weapons programs. Bush invaded Iraq before the U.N. weapons inspection team could complete its search for banned weapons. By contrast, Kaye's inspection will take another 6 to 9 months to complete its inspections. Professor Ambrose Lane Sr., host of We Ourselves on Pacifica Station WPFW in Washington, D.C., says there were compelling reasons for the invasion of Iraq other than weapons of mass destruction. Prior to the invasion, Lane spoke of the battle between the euro and the U.S. dollar as a result reserve currency in world financial markets. Saddam Hussein had begun using the euro instead of the U.S. dollar for the U.N.-sanctioned oil for food program, which severely weakened the value of the dollar in foreign markets. After the invasion, the U.N. lifted its sanctions on the sale of Iraqi oil that fell outside of the provisions of oil for food. The U.S.-appointed government then reinstated the dollar as a currency for the sale of Iraqi oil, and all Iraqi funds and foreign banks were converted from the euro to the dollar. scholar. Yesterday on Peace Watch, we aired part one of a lecture by Lane that places our present economic realities in a historical context. Today, Lane continues to explore the economic issues that he says were the impetus for the U.S. invasion of Iraq.
Our government plans to reverse the various negative economic trends by seizing the world's richest oil-producing regions. And this it deems necessary for three related reasons. One, securing United States supplies. First, our country is increasingly dependent on oil imports. Already a little over half of our daily consumption of 20 million barrels is imported. We import oil from a variety of sources: Canada, Venezuela, Nigeria, Saudi Arabia, even Iraq. But our own production is falling and will continue to fall steadily even as our consumption continues to grow. In the future, it will become increasingly dependent on oil from West Asia, North Africa, a region where the masses of ordinary people despise this country, where three of the leading oil producers, Iraq, Iran, and Libya, are professedly anti-American, and the others, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, the United Arab Emirates, are in danger of being toppled by anti-American forces. This country cannot escape the simple arithmetic. The U.S. Department of Energy and the International Energy Agency both project that global oil demand could grow from the current 77 million barrels a day to 120 million barrels a day in 20 years, driven by the United States and the emerging markets of South and East Asia. The agencies assume that most of the supply required to meet this demand must come from OPEC, whose production is expected to jump from 28 million barrels a day in 1998 to 60 million barrels a day in 2020. Virtually all of this increase would come from the Middle East, especially Saudi Arabia. A simple fact explains this conclusion. 63% of the world's proven oil reserves are in the Middle East, 25% in Saudi Arabia alone. Over the past decade, the increase in the United States' share of the oil market in terms of trade was higher than the total oil consumption in any other country except Japan and China. Our increase in imports accounts for more than a third of the total increase in oil trade and more than half of the total increase in OPEC's production during the 1990s. This fact alone, according to Edward Morris and James Richard, writing in Foreign Affairs magazine, April of 2002, in an article entitled "The Battle for Energy Dominance." This fact, together with the fall in U.S. oil production, means that the United States will remain the single most important force in the oil market. Now, given our growing dependence on oil imports, this country cannot afford to allow the oil-producing regions to be under the influence of any other power or independent. Second reason, maintaining the dollar hegemony. Second, if other imperialist powers were able to displace U.S. dominance in the region, the dollar would be dealt a severe blow. The pressure for switching to the euro would become irresistible and would ring the death knell of dollar supremacy. Control of U.S. oil would preserve the rule of the dollar and hurt the credibility of the euro. In the 1990s, the major OPEC countries raced to invite foreign investment again to carry out massive new developments. In the late 1990s, Venezuela, Iraq, and Iran struck massive deals with foreign firms for major fields. Even Saudi Arabia invited proposals for development of its untapped natural gas reserves. However, American firms were shut out of Iran and Iraq by their own government's sanctions. In other words, American sanctions kept American firms from getting any contracts. French, Russian, and Chinese firms got the contracts. Chavez's increasing assertiveness threatens to shut American firms out of Venezuela as well. And the Saudi deal, which the American firms were to lead, stands canceled, apparently because of the Saudi government's fear of public resentment. Thus, if it does not invade the West Asian region, the United States stands to lose dollar hegemony by losing control of the major oil field development projects in the next decade. Third reason, oil as a weapon. Direct American control of oil would render potential challengers for world or regional supremacy dependent on us. So it's clear the United States is following this policy. As we mentioned, French, Russian, and Chinese firms will get evicted from Iran and Iraq once United States troops enter. Now, the United States has gone to great lengths to frustrate alternatives to Baku-Ceyhan pipeline, which is run from the Caspian through Turkey to the Mediterranean. With the United States invasion of Afghanistan, we have set up a chain of military bases in Central and South Asia, in Pakistan, Afghanistan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, and Uzbekistan, with military advisors in Georgia as well. Our government has sent Marines to help suppress the insurgency, we call it, in Colombia. And we're training a new brigade to protect Occidental Petroleum's pipeline in that country, while at the same time we're actively organizing the overthrow of the elected Chavez government in Venezuela. And according to Michael Peel, writing in the Financial Times magazine, July 25th, 2002, an article entitled, U.S. Takes Great Look at West African Oil. It's reported that the Institute for Advanced Strategic and Political Studies, which is an Israeli lobby that met the President Obasanjo of Nigeria in July of 2002, claims that the United States is on the verge of a, quote, historic strategic alignment with West Africa, and that that region is receptive to American presence. The Institute has advocated the setting up of a United States Gulf of Guinea military command, and a little island south of Nigeria, and a possible site for a naval base, hosted a visit from a U.S. general in the same month. Now, that activity came while the Nigerian government was considering leaving OPEC and developing its oil trading relationship with the United States instead. The region already produces 15% of our oil imports, and these are set to rise to 25% by the year 2015. According to the U.S. Energy Information Administration, in an article they prepared titled Top Petroleum Net Importers in the Year 2000, the United Kingdom, they found, is a net exporter of oil thanks to the North Sea oil. The United States, however, imported in the year 2000 9.8 million barrels a day of our 19.5 million barrel requirement. That is about half. By contrast, Japan imported 5.5 million barrels a day out of its 5.6 million barrels. Germany imported 2.7 million barrels out of its required 2.8 million barrels. France, 2 million barrels out of its 2.1 million barrel requirement. Italy, 1.8 out of 2.0. And Spain, 1.5 out of 1.5. In other words, all of its oil comes from imports. Now we know why Spain is so strong in support of what we're doing in the United Nations and what we're planning to do in Iraq. In other words, according to our own documents, the United States Energy Information Administration, these countries imported 90 to 100% of all of their oil requirements. They would therefore be very vulnerable to blackmail by a power which is able to dictate the destination of oil. In the aftermath of World War II, to show you that this is not new, our government had invested large sums in rehabilitating the devastated economies of Europe, which is known as the Marshall Plan. It used the plan in order to dictate changes in European economies that made them switch from using their own coal to using oil, which American oil companies in West Asia were in the best position to supply. Now, a major consideration in our grab for oil is our desire to check China. In coming years, China, like the United States, will become a major importer of oil and gas. It is projected to import 10 million barrels a day by the year 2030 and more than 8% of world oil demand. As China attempts to arrange its future oil supplies, it has found itself checked at every point by the United States. Since the mid-1990s, China has been pressing for a gas pipeline from the Caspian region to China. And China took the initiative to form a group called the Shanghai Five, later the Shanghai Six, consisting of China, Russia, and the relevant Central Asian states, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, and later Uzbekistan. With the United States' invasion of Afghanistan, and with the installation of our forces in the very countries who were to be in the Shanghai grouping, China's initiative was sabotaged. On a visit to Iran, Chinese president declared, and I quote, "Beijing's policy is against strategies of force, and the U.S. military presence in Central Asia and the Middle East region. Beijing would work together with developing nations to counter American hegemony." Now, in the year 2002, Chinese firms have bought two Indonesian fields for $585 million and $262 million, respectively. Indonesia's president has visited China twice since becoming president in 2001, hoping to bag a $9 billion contract to supply liquid natural gas to power industries in southern China. The United States has stepped up its activities in the vicinity of Indonesia, forcing the Philippines to accept its so-called help in hunting fundamentalists, patrolling the Malacca Straits in tandem with the Indian Navy, and pressing Indonesia to accept U.S. cooperation in suppressing al-Qaeda elements in Indonesia itself. But a December 2001 RAND Corporation, which is one of the major institutions used by the ruling classes in this country, they made a presentation to a committee of Congress on what they call threats to the security and stability of Southeast Asia and to U.S. security interest in the region. That report said that the primary area of concern is China's emergence as a major regional power. China's assertiveness, RAND declared, will increase as its power grows. And RAND speculated that, quote, conflict could be triggered by energy exploration or exploitation activities, and recommended the creation of a, quote, comprehensive security network in the Asia-Pacific region, end of quote. And then, discarding the then U.S. cover story that we were hunting for a handful of Abu Sayyaf guerrillas in the Philippines, the RAND Corporation said that, quote, the U.S. should provide urgently needed air defense and naval patrol assets to the Philippines to help Manila reestablish deterrence vis-a-vis China and give a further impetus to the revitalization of the United States-Philippine defense relationship. The U.S. should expand and diversify its access and support arrangements in Southeast Asia to be able to effectively respond in a timely manner to unexpected contingencies. After all, said the RAND report, 6 months ago, who would have thought that the U.S. armed forces would be confronted with the need to plan and execute a military campaign in Afghanistan? Now, finally, like the U.S., China cannot avoid reliance on West Asian oil. China has struck oil field development deals with the very countries in West Asia hit by U.S. sanctions: Iraq, Iran, Libya, and Sudan. With this entire region now to be targeted in the impending invasion, China's deals are sure to meet the same fate as its Central Asian pipeline. Hardly surprising, then, that Chinese leaders believe that the United States seeks to contain China, and the United States is therefore a major threat to China's energy security. And this was pointed out in a Reuters report dated September 24, 2002, titled, "China Digs for Middle East Oil, U.S. Gets Fired Up." Now, the thrust is clear. Once we have seized the oil wells of West Asia, the United States will determine not only which firms would bag the deals, not only the currency in which all trade would be denominated, not only the price of oil on the international market, but even the destination of the oil. In the short term, it seems likely that the conventional armed forces of the Iraqi regime depleted to at least one-third of their 1990 strength would pose much of a problem for the U.S.'s initial occupation of Iraq. The United States assesses that it would be in a better position to take the immediate impact of higher oil prices than other countries, while we have to recognize that the oil price hike would have an impact on all countries importing oil throughout the world. First, we have higher disposable income than the rest of the world, and net energy imports account for just under 1% of our gross domestic product. Secondly, our imports represent a smaller share of our energy needs. We also have a strategic petroleum reserve of 580 million barrels, or almost 2 months' imports. And if you note, just recently, this administration had more oil placed into those reserves. And no one ever asked the question why. Moreover, our economy depends less on heavy industry. We've exported most of our heavy industry, and so we don't have the same needs as other imperialist or third world countries have. And third, at times of international crisis, capital docks at safe harbors. And our government anticipates that as it demonstrates its might before the rest of the world, and the world's oil supplies fall into our hands, investors would put their money back on the dollar. Now, such a strategy would have a perverse effect even if it succeeds, because as the dollar's value rises, American goods would be displaced at home by the then even cheaper imports. U.S. business investment would fall even further. It's already fallen virtually to the capital replacement level, shrinking the manufacturing base. And the trade deficit would widen even further. But the United States would pay for it with inflows of foreign capital seeking security in the then powerful dollar. James K. Galbraith, writing in the American Prospect magazine on November 18, 2002, in an article entitled "The Unbearable Costs of Empire," addressed this. He said, "The picture is one of consumption without production, dependent on inflows of borrowed foreign capital, which inflows are in turn dependent on American military supremacy." So our grand strategy, while portending tremendous upheaval and suffering for the rest of the world, has its logic. It's a pattern familiar to any student of imperialism, that is, a declining imperialist power relying on military power and possession of colonies to make up for its ebbing economic strength. However, our military course to maintaining our long-term world hegemony is fraught with difficulties that would be familiar also to students of imperialism. There are huge costs to a strategy of imperial expansion on a weakening productive base. Even without a war, U.S. military spending swallows 4% of the gross domestic product. The U.S. military budget this year has increased more than $48 billion over the previous year. By comparison, U.S. military spending during the Cold War, when the U.S. faced a formidable nuclear-armed adversary, the Soviet Union, averaged about $30 billion less in 2002 dollars. And the cost of invasion of Iraq is hard to estimate. The 1991 assault on Iraq cost $61 billion, of which $48 billion was paid for by the U.S. allies. I haven't seen a single U.S. ally volunteer to pay costs for this venture. Now, we've had costs escalating to as much as $95 billion. And one estimate coming out of Yale University said that if we not only invade but occupy Iraq for a considerable period of time, it would go to as high as $1.6 trillion. Where would we get the money? Well, the required funds would have to be borrowed. But this time, when the U.S. is in recession and we're pushing up the U.S. budget deficit, it's going to be much more difficult. In order to maintain our hegemony over diverse and shifting potential adversaries, we are obliged to set up a vast network of military bases. The 1991 assault on Iraq helped bring about the U.S. bases in Saudi Arabia. Our intervention in Bosnia and later our assault on Yugoslavia brought bases on the rim of Europe in case Europe should secede from the U.S.-dominated NATO. And you notice that NATO has been under attack by this administration. Now, since the invasion of Afghanistan, our bases, United States bases, have sprung up in Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and U.S. military advisors are stationed in Georgia. John Pike, a military analyst, was quoted in an article in the Associated Press titled U.S. Expands Military Ties Worldwide, said, "Overall, the American military global presence is more pervasive today than at any point in American history." But bases are not enough. We need to suppress the masses, the mass and political forces that are struggling against us in these diverse regions. To meet this need, there is a massive hike in U.S. spending to train military, foreign militaries, which had already risen steeply during the 1990s. By 1999, U.S. Special Operations Forces were carrying out joint exercises with 152 countries. It's like the counterinsurgency era all over again. The U.S. congressional aide is quoted as saying, referring to the Vietnam War era, "Only this time we're going to be fighting terrorism instead of communism." This was reported in the Los Angeles Times, June 1st, 2002, in an article entitled U.S. Military Bases and Empire. Now, the growing military assaults by our country are giving rise to a worldwide protest movement that in some ways is without precedent. The single strong point of the United States, ironically, that is its awe-inspiring high-tech military might, has not been able to deliver it a thoroughgoing success even in Afghanistan. In South Korea, an extraordinary mass movement is waging at present, calling for U.S. withdrawal from that country. In the Philippines, fresh efforts to install U.S. forces is already confronting mass protests from a people who were America's first overseas colony. And of course, you know, we were going to send another 3,000, but the Philippine Constitution held that up. We're trying to negotiate now with what we're going to do there. In Pakistan, the only parliamentary platform campaigning for the removal of American bases made dramatic gains in Musharraf's carefully managed elections. The New York Times reported that a recent worldwide opinion poll by the Pew Research Center showed 69% of Pakistanis held an unfavorable view of the United States, and only 10% expressed a favorable one. Of the 44 countries surveyed, Pakistan tied with Egypt for the most negative perception of the United States. Even in Kuwait, as American troops prepare for the invasion of Iraq, they are facing repeated attacks from the population whom they supposedly saved in 1991. A Kuwait official is quoted as saying, and I quote, "The Americans have told us to downplay these incidents for fear of creating the sort of climate in which further attacks can happen." And that you'll find that in the Daily Telegraph, an article written by Jack Fairweather entitled "U.S. Covers Up Killings of Its Troops in Kuwait."
Ambrose Eilane Sr. is the producer and host of We Ourselves from Pacifica Station WPFW in Washington, D.C. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.